All right. I think we're going to go ahead and get started. Hopefully has their fill of tacos. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. For those of you who aren't familiar, this is the local chapter of the IXDA, and we try to host events like this about once a month. It's an all-volunteer organization, so if you want to learn about future events or get involved, we have a mailing list in the back. Just jot down your email and we'll keep you up to date. But tonight, we have Paul Pangaro, and Paul is a professor of practice in the Human-Computer Interaction Institute at Carnegie Mellon. And he's been designing conversational interfaces throughout his long career, originally in the context of adaptive learning and conversation with content in text-based systems, as many of us remember, I imagine. He has worked with and within software startups in New York and Boston and Silicon Valley in product and technology roles. And before joining us in Pittsburgh to be at CMU just earlier this year, he was the chair and associate professor of the MFA Interaction Design Program at the College for Creative Studies in Detroit. So Paul is a seasoned expert and scholar on the topic of conversation design, and we're very lucky to have him with us today. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Seth. At some risk, is it possible that you might hear me without a microphone? I know that's annoying when you really can't hear me, but I think it might be more troublesome. You're pointing that way.
Unfortunately, the machinery over here
is too loud.
Yeah.
So I have to do this. Is that better?
It's very breathy. It's going in and out, so it's not even reliable.
Okay. Please proceed, just projecting. Thanks, Paul.
It read my preferences. So thank you all for coming. I appreciate it. I'm aware of the contradiction in wanting to give some insights about conversation in a format that is not a conversation. That's not lost on me, but it seems to be practical and expedient, and you're willing to join. That's what conversations are, after all, is participants who are willing to join. You're welcome to leave at any time. Meaning that you have the right to do that if you wish. And that is the volitional nature of conversation, which I think is one of its more important factors. This crazy thing you're looking at here is the last project I did when I was in Detroit, as Simon just mentioned, chairing an interaction design department. I want to give a brief introduction to it because it bookends what I'm trying to say today. In 1968, there was an exhibition in London called Cybernetic Serendipity. This is the original poster. And there were about 60,000 visitors over the course of 11 weeks or so. And it was an absolute sensation. It was the first comprehensive exhibition bringing together all possible forms of computer art, or cybernetic art, as they preferred to call it in those days. These are some gallery shots very quickly. There were only a couple of things that moved and fewer things that interacted. And this is the way it looked in 1968. This was called The Colloquy of Mobiles by Gordon Pask, P-A-S-K, whose name you'll hear again and again this evening. And it comprised these rather strange shaped things. These large figures that are round are called female figures. And the rectangular black and white ones are male figures, and they have a kind of conversation. It's a simple one, but it's also a sophisticated one. And my claim is that when you're talking to Siri, it's not as sophisticated as that. Now, I realize that's an outrageous claim, but I hope to give you the sense in which I mean that tonight. Here's Gordon Pask, the man who designed it. People say, oh yeah, he was an artist. Well, yes, but he was much more than that, as you'll hear. This woman was a designer who did the female forms. She was a very prominent ballet designer of sets and costumes.
I'm so sorry to interrupt, Paul, but it really is too much to hear in the back.
Is it working again?
Should work slowly.
Should work. I apologize for those who couldn't hear me.
So,
tell me if it's too poppy. you know what I mean? Because I could even do that, it's not a joke. And also, just raise your hand if I get too soft, okay? Thanks, apologies. So this is the way it looked in 1968, and this is the way it looked last year in 2018. We worked hard to make a reproduction that looked and behaved the way the original did, although we weren't interested in being masochistic and trying to build it out of analog electronics. There are 11 Arduinos working completely asynchronously. And this is the way it looked in 2018. The mastermind of the design and fabrication of this, TJ McLeish, made it possible. And many students worked on it, students in the program that I was chairing at two levels, the first and second year and master's. And this is how it looked. I want to tell you very briefly what it did. So the male is sending a signal saying, I'm number one, are you interested in me? And if the female gets the signal and is interested in him, she stops, wiggles her mirror, which reflects the light from the male to the female back to the male. The male turns his light on continuously, and as the light flickers, I'm taking it here with a question, his drive is satisfied. Very thinly veiled, right? But there are aspects of cooperation and competition. There are ways in which there are multiple layers in the conversation. It's not simply a reactive thing. It's actually rather sophisticated. And of course, it's analog and organic. It looks like it fell from the sky. And it has qualities of immersion and novelty and surprise that Siri does not. Here's a set of interactions with people in the audience who came and enjoyed playing as if they were also mobiles. And the reproduction of this was interesting, at least, and it's become so interested around the world that it's going to be shown in the Centre Pompidou in Paris starting in February, and we've been doing some upgrades to it. We just learned about a month ago that there are things that we never knew how it worked. Some guy wrote an email to somebody else 20 years ago and said, oh, by the way, it did this, and we went, really? I didn't know that. So we're in the middle of upgrades. It's in Detroit. And the museum, the ZKM on the right, is a museum of media arts, and that's where it will enter the permanent collection. So I provide that just as evidence that it was an amazing piece in 68, and we're very proud to have done it now. And again, I'm using it as an exemplar of conversation to kind of jostle the idea of what conversation means in your head. Because I mean something much broader than just talking to Siri. So, I'd like to start with a parable. I call it the parable of Luigi's Pizza. I need someone who's willing to engage in a very brief exchange with me and who is willing to be insulted. It's a trigger warning. I'm quite serious. Simon, may I use you? Would it be
sure.
Safe? So, please ask me now, where is there good pizza?
Hey, Paul, where can I get some good pizza?
The best pizza's across the street at Luigi's Pizza. Now, ask me, why is it good pizza?
Why do you think it's good?
Screw you, I'm not going to tell you. Surprising, right? I just described Google. Right? Is that okay? Is that okay that Google is willing to tell you what it thinks, but not tell you why it thinks it? Not tell you why it has the preferences it has? If a person did that to you, you would never speak to them again, would you? And yet we allow our machines to treat us this way, and we speak to them happily day after day. This is a problem for me, and this is what I'm here to try to address. So this is about conversational interfaces of all kinds, speaking, texting, dancing. And I propose that we start by applying models of human conversation. We've been doing it for some disagreement, 60,000 years, probably, maybe 100, maybe 200, nobody really knows. And strive for interfaces that are these words, cooperative, ethical, and humane. So it's going to get a little intense, I warn you. And then push for new forms of conversation and conversational interactions in our devices. So this is what I'm here to offer this evening. This is what I hope. We're not there yet, are we? I don't think so. So it's unfair to keep going from here without saying what is conversation. And I want to bring you on a very quick tour of that, okay? So this is the accelerated part of the evening. A conversation, from the point of view of conversation theory, as defined by Gordon Pask, the guy who designed Colloquy of Mobiles, but also, is this still working? Yes. But also has a theory of conversations and an extensive amount of experimentation and theoretical work and implementation work, which I won't talk about tonight. The claim is that a conversation always has a goal. It might be implicit, explicit, fair, unfair, spoken, unspoken. You're sitting here because you have an interest in being here. That's your goal. That's why you're willing to have at least this interchange and maybe even a conversation. So from there, participant A chooses a context to begin the conversation and begins speaking in a language. The context might be a moment in time. It might be a situation of a relationship. And the language has to start sufficiently shared such that you understand the first few words I'm saying, such that we can keep going, and then you might be interested to hear something that might be new. And so this action of beginning an exchange might evoke a response. There are many possible responses. Here, why don't you look at what some of the responses might be? But ultimately, if the goal of the participant on the right is sufficiently compatible with the goal of the participant on the left, then the reaction invokes a reaction and they continue. Maybe they decide to stop. So again, I'm trying to sketch what a conversation is because I can't talk about conversation without at least trying to define it. And I want to make sure that we're on a common ground with that. So an agreement may be reached. That's a really good taco. I wish I didn't have to use a microphone. Do you agree with that? You may not agree with that. Right? Let's go have dinner. Let's do a musical together. That's an old joke. Let's build a product. Let's start a company. Let's make a movement. These are all kinds of agreements. And I say that they require conversation. Now, a transaction may occur in certain kinds of interactions where you offer me something and I pay you for it, or in exchange for a barter agreement, we enter into some common interactions. And to complete the idea, I've just coined this cute and slightly punning phrase, context, language, engagement, agreement, transaction, cleat. It's traction. It's the way to get transaction in a conversation. And you certainly have to have the first three in order to begin a conversation. And if the conversation is useful, you might end up in agreement and in actions and transactions together. We'll say more about that in a moment. There are many types of conversation, but what's an effective conversation? My claim, and the claim of my colleagues, is a conversation in which something changes and brings, hopefully, lasting value, but some value to one or more participants. Something has to change. Hi, how are you? I'm good. No change. Not a conversation yet. Hi, how are you? Well, you know, I'm not feeling well. Oh, really? What's wrong? Well, I have a cold. Oh, I'm sorry. That's a little bit of information. Right? And on from there. Now, this changes thing is important. There may be information, informational, transactional, rational, emotional. Right? This is just the range. And there's a paper, by the way, I should have mentioned, if you go to my site, pangaro.com/IXDA2019, all the slides are there and many other references. And that'll come up again in a later slide. Why does it matter? Well, if we're going to do something together, we have to agree on what we're doing, right? We can't go to dinner together or start a company together unless we reach the agreement to do that. It's kind of common sense. It seems a little silly to have to say. But to reach an agreement, we have to have this exchange. And to have the exchange, we have to have a shared language to begin. We have to have some of the components in this little cartoon diagram here. And ultimately, to cooperate, to act together, to collaborate, to invent together, requires conversation. So this conversation thing is quite important. We okay so far? You can hear me. That's not much of a conversation, but I'm trying to connect a little bit. I really much prefer to sit and talk than to do this. But thank you for your patience. A lot of things come from a conversation. In terms of interpersonal relationships, these are some of the things that might come. I claim that conversation has to precede these things. And the unity idea is, I think, particularly beautiful. We act together as if we were one. Here's another set, more at the level of society, groups, more at the level of groups. Would any of these things be possible without a conversation? I don't think so. So, this is an interaction design association. I've been talking about conversation. How does this all fit together? What is an interaction versus what is a conversation? This is a person, a user, a human. And there's this screen there, there's this interface in the form of a readout, something that the user sees. And as a consequence of seeing it, sorry, it's driven by a machine, this little mu, this Greek word mu, Greek letter, M for machine. Think of that as a mechanical, electrical, digital thing that drives the display. But there's also a button, a touchable interface, something that the human can give input through, and that completes the loop, right? They're very familiar, easy, nothing surprising here. But what I think is interesting about this diagram is it doesn't say what the interaction is about. It says that there's an interaction, there's an action, and the machine does something, and the machine puts something on the screen, et cetera, right? But that's not the important part. What's important is what's going on in the head, the mind, the body of the human. So we talk about interaction design endlessly, and sometimes we talk about user needs and user wants and goals and intents. That's where I'm going, okay? So while the user is using this thing, being the user, hopefully being the user as opposed to being used, that's an old joke. Let's now separate out two different things, the actions from the desires and the goals behind the actions. So if I want to find out where I can go have dinner, I then approach my phone. But the dinner idea is up here and the action is down there. That's the visual terminology that PASC developed that I'm using here. But of course, this thing that I'm interacting with is on the other side of a dividing line. And when it's a human, you know that the human is driven by thoughts and wants and desires and human nature and all those kinds of things. So it's not unusual to know that a person has these things in their mind when you're talking to them or interacting with them. It's common to expect the other human being to be a mirror of you and to have things that she wants or he wants while you're talking about what you want. And ultimately, you may coordinate and act together. But the terminology is up above is goals and below is action. So let's go back to the machine situation. If I, as a human on the left, operate acting but also having a goal, then the machine is acting and also has a goal. Now, not in the same way that humans do, but there's some goal in there somewhere. Some programmer built it. Or it's inventing its own, if it's an AI and you want to think of it that way. So let's talk for a minute about what the machine's goal is, and let's use Luigi's pizza as an example. If I ask, where is there a good pizza? And I'm interacting with the machine and I'm waiting for an answer, and it says Luigi's pizza is the best, it still has a goal somewhere, because somebody wrote the code and has a goal behind telling me that Luigi's is the best. Follow me? Just trying to make the parallel between humans and machines. Why don't we think more about the machine's goals? Well, because we're you know, we forgive easily, right? We don't want to say somebody screw you, and we don't talk to that person anymore. But when the machine says screw you, we don't notice it. We don't realize that we're being treated in this, I think, rather nasty way. So let's talk about that. When it says screw you, I'm not going to tell you why. It has some terrible thing in mind for its goal. It's saying, I don't care about you. I care about the money I'm making from telling you whatever I want, and I'm not going to tell you what it is. Excuse me. Why it is. Are we tracking? Make sense? All the time, we're willing to interact with humans in this architecture, and now I want to talk about interacting with machines in this architecture of two levels of action and intent. So we might have a conversation about what we shall do, what we might do, what we will do, and a conversation about why we shall do it. That's really what this is talking about. Also, in a technical sense, what's going on here is a cybernetic system, forgive the terminology. I don't mean cybernetics in the sense of AI and robots, I mean in the sense of feedback and feedback loops upon feedback loops. So I take an action. Did I get over to my water? Yes, I did. What was my goal? My goal was to drink something. Did I achieve my goal of drinking? Yes, so now I can go back. So we act in nested loops and we talk back and forth in nested loops. Oops. What happened? It jumped ahead. I'm sorry. This is the formal mechanism. No, you don't have to memorize it. I'm just trying to tell you that there's a formalism under that. And this is a diagram drawn by Gordon Pask. Here he is in his study with his wife around the time I worked with him. He was on my PhD committee and I worked with him for some time afterwards. And here he is talking.
Giving, say, two explanations at once will be represented by putting a marker of some sort on some of these and saying we're dealing with conversations as the things we study. We're not much interested in what the conversation is about. We're interested in how it takes place. And the hypotheses we test are about how people understand or learn or what can be known and can't be about processes in conversations. I mean somebody with the wit and the guts to go and do and create. And that, I believe, is what education is all about.
That's Gordon. Anybody know Doctor Who? Series Doctor Who? The very first Doctor Who was probably fashioned after him. True story. True story. And I think you can see it. But I'm not trying to portray him as a madman. I'm trying to portray him as a genius, which is what I believe he was. He wrote a bunch of books. This is a book in which he wrote a piece. This is Soft Architecture Machines. The book was the creation of Nicholas Negroponte, who later formed the Media Lab. And Nicholas asked Gordon to write a chapter to introduce the idea of machine intelligence. And in that chapter, Gordon wrote a bunch of diagrams, which Nicholas published as is. Gordon was expecting him to re-render them as graphic designers would clean them up. And Nicholas had the genius idea to just reproduce them. And it's from this piece that he develops the conversation theory idea. I'm going to take you through just a little bit of this. So interactions occur through an interface, right? Starting from ground zero. Interactions among participants here in A and a B. And here he begins to pull out these ideas of levels of goals and levels of action, means. Now, this is the more complicated version. You've seen this before. It's the red looping back and forth of the infinite loop. It's the arrows upon arrows in the double feedback loop. It's the formal mechanism of all of those feedback loops drawn out. This is the environment, which is acted upon by these participants. As I said, it's parallel to this. It's the same diagram. But here's where it gets interesting. Pask had the idea of having a conversation with a machine about designing something. So this is not a conversation where the architect imagines what to build and the machine gives you the 3D rendering or tells you how thick the beam has to be in order to build it. But the goals of the design, we want to create a space that's uniform, we want to allow certain kinds of flow, we want it to be a tall ceiling, we want to have an escalator nearby. I'm not sure about that choice. But these are design goal decisions. And so PASC proposed, and Negroponte had, the Architecture Machine Group, predecessor to the Media Lab, which was founded on the idea that you could build a machine in which a computer, in which a computer and a human could have a conversation about design at multiple levels. We could talk about our goals, we could talk about our means to achieve them. This was the concept of the architecture machine. Unfortunately, this is an hasn't come about. Got left behind when Negroponte decided to start the Media Lab. This, for me, would be the ultimate kind of machine to talk to, in which I could say, I want to go somewhere, but this is why I want to go somewhere. And it would say, really, that's why. That's interesting. Are there other reasons why? Are there better reasons why? Did you imagine this reason why? Because a conversation for possibilities is a far richer conversation than what time is it? What's the weather tomorrow? Will you buy me more dishwashing liquid? Which is about the way Alexa runs today. So how do we get there? How do we go with these models into a space where we imagine better conversational systems? I'm going to take just a short pause here. My goal is to drink so that I don't become dehydrated, so that I don't die, right? Level upon level upon level. Question?
Yeah. Let's say you achieve this and the computer has a goal. Did someone design that goal or did it come up with it by itself?
This is the classic sci-fi question. If a man, a human, man is the old-fashioned way of saying it, and there are many quotes of that, unfortunately. If a human designs a machine and the machine ends up doing something, is that actually the creation of the human? I believe that the best way to think about that is all things arise in interaction. So I can interact with you, and we can try to make something, and we can interact with 20 people in the room, and we can probably do better because we have more variety and capability in the 20 people than in the two. So I don't think the consequence of that conversation between two or 20 is about you or me or any one of the individuals. So I'm going to punt the question and say, it's not the machine that's doing it anyway. It's the interaction between the machines and the humans. So I don't care about that particular philosophical question. All things are interactive. There is nothing that is valuable that is not an interaction. It's a pretty outrageous claim. Pin me against the wall about that later. So if you have this architecture of goals at one level and means at another, or intent and action, as I said earlier, then one kind of conversation, and I'll use some Alexa examples, is, hi Alexa, give me news from NPR. So I'm saying what I want, the news, and how I want to get it, NPR. I am saying I want both the goals and the means, so I'm controlling it. It's a bit like saying, I'd like a hamburger, please go across the street to Denny's and bring it to me. That's one kind of conversation we can have. Another kind of conversation is in which I say, I'd like a hamburger, but what do you think? Is there a good place to get a hamburger? Do you have places to get hamburgers? I can't think, I'm new to Pittsburgh. Do you have any ideas? So it's a case where one participant is specifying the goal, but negotiating or allowing openness in how the goal is achieved. That's a different kind of conversation. That's like saying, Alexa, I want to listen to some news. What do you got? And it can do that a little bit. You can also just give the goal and not at all be concerned with how it's fulfilled. Alexa, give me some news. Now, you might care if it's picking CNN or Fox News or Breitbart or Facebook or some Russian channel, explicitly or not. So we probably do want to be concerned about how the machine is achieving the goal, how it's doing the means down below. But this is still a valid question. If you trusted your machine, you would be willing to say this. If you didn't trust it, you wouldn't. If I trust you as a friend to bring me something that's a hamburger that I can eat, then I don't have to say, where'd you get it? Right? Lastly, and most importantly, this is where A and B decide on the goals together. What would you like to do tonight? But of course, what we would like to do is dependent on why we would like to do it. Because we enjoy each other's time. Because we want to work together on a project and we haven't finished that request for proposal response and we don't have any research money. We simply want to hang out because we enjoy each other's company. These are all valid reasons for wanting to collaborate on what we might do tonight. And I hope you can see, I'm trying to ask the question, how do we make our machines have these kinds of variations to be more like human? So, a couple of dense slides coming up. What's a good conversation? It's one which stays focused, doesn't switch to Chinese, doesn't start going off to the deep end if you only speak English, which would be my case. Keeps a continuity, leads to agreements, even you like that, but I don't like that. That's okay. And enables a coordination. So how well does Alexa do this today? Does some of it, right? I don't know about the agreements to disagree, but I could certainly ask it to order me a new hamburger. What's a great conversation? That's a higher bar. Evolves in ways you couldn't evolve on your own. I want that. I want that in the conversations I have. Gordon was amazing. I learned from him many things, and one was that he would speak to anyone on the same basis as anyone else, whether it's the person driving the car, or another professor, or his client, or the person behind the counter in an airport lounge. And he was always looking for these kinds of things. Not in a dramatic way or in an egotistical way, but rather he wanted the kinds of interactions that went somewhere, that meant something, that were human to human. And this sensibility suffuses his whole theory. As abstract as it can be, it's still a very humanistic theory. And I think it distinguishes itself from AI in that way. That's another story. So why can't today's conversation interfaces do these things? Because people aren't thinking about it this way. What can I do with an automatic speech recognition and a natural language processor? And how do I parse the sentence? And how do I then take that sentence and say, okay, that's good. Yeah. Anyone know what Eliza is? E-L-I-Z-A, Eliza. Eliza is the very first chatbot. It's worth going to the web, say Eliza chatbot, and play with it. And realize it's not much better than that. And that was about the same age as the colloquy of mobiles. And it was exclusively a chatbot. But what's a great partner? Offers different ways to achieve your goal or collaborates with you to define new goals. It's a way of saying what those diagrams with the arrows are trying to show. Helps you to be what you want to be or become. It's an evolutionary path about conversation. If an effective conversation changes you in a lasting way that has value, then you become someone new as a result of conversation. My claim is all learning comes from conversations. My claim is passes. By this definition of conversation, you only learn through conversation. Even if you're reading a book, and you're reading the sentence, and you're comparing it to what you already know. So you're having a conversation between your prior knowledge and this new knowledge. And that's how you gain new insights and can become someone new. This is what's important about this. So we're in what is almost the last section. And I want designers and technologists to have ethical intentions. And for me, ethical intentions in the context of conversational interfaces are, first, to build interfaces that are cooperative. And I would define conversation as a cooperative interface when there are sequences of coherent actions that enable an evolution of points of view such that understanding and agreement occurs. So this is another way of talking about that, but from the point of view of an ethical point of view. I want to be more explicit about ethics, and now we're back to Luigi's Pizza. It's an ethical interface when there is reliable transparency of the what and the why. Where is there good pizza? What? What's good about? You know, what's the good pizza? Luigi's. Why is that good pizza? Because it's sustainably sourced, because it's right across the street and you're supporting your community, because it tastes good, because they treat their people well, because I like the owner. It doesn't matter why, but to be transparent about that, for me, is the minimum ethical situation. And that's why Google Now is not an ethical interface. Because it doesn't tell you why Luigi's is the best. Now I know what you're thinking. What you're thinking is that Google does tell you why it's telling you Luigi's Pizza. It says, oh, we have 200 reasons. And those reasons are amazing. And it's about recency and about reviews and about Yelp and about this and about what you put before and about your history, all these things. That's why we told you Luigi's Pizza is good. But no, they're not answering the specific question about Luigi's. They're essentially saying, read our terms and conditions and go to hell. So it's an apparent transparency, but it's not a specific transparency because it says you have to read all these things, and that to me is not humane. So I would like to call a humane interface when any participant can change the focus and the flow so that you can collaborate. So you should be able to say to the Luigi's Pizza answer, no, tell me why, and it starts to give you 27 reasons, and you say, stop. And you say, do they have gluten-free? Because unless you can interrupt its flow, you're subject to what it wants to do with you or to you. So that's inhumane, because that's treating me like a machine. That's treating me like this passive thing that has to take whatever you send to me. So this is my goal, is to talk about this and then to try to make it as pragmatic as possible. And I have on occasion built such systems, not quite the same as this ideal camera.
I just wanted to ask you about, you said apparent transparency, and then you were talking about terms and conditions. Isn't it really the legal transparency? Like that is the minimum viable legal requirement, and maybe if you wanted something else, you would have to have a legal requirement for a specific.
It's a great distinction that you're making. Cameron's saying that the reason why there are terms and conditions is for legal reasons and liability and protection reasons. And that's different than what I'm asking as a requirement for something that is ethical and humane. So I'm not saying I don't want that, but I'm saying that is not sufficient to satisfy me, because people say, well, Paul, you know, it tells you what it's thinking about and how it's doing what it's doing. But again, my complaint is, this doesn't tell me right then now. It's a bit like saying, I'm gonna give you this advice, and then you say, why am I giving you this advice? And my answer is, because it's the best thing for you. Don't worry about it, I got you. Now that requires an extraordinary amount of trust, which I would convey to my parents, perhaps, my partner, my best friends, my trusted colleagues, but to a stranger? I don't think so. So this is why I'm going in the direction that I'm trying to go. We're almost done. I believe that we should place conversation at the heart of interaction design, and I choose that biological and emotional and human word quite intentionally because of all of the powerful things that conversation offers. Because without conversation, we cannot evolve. We cannot collaborate. We cannot learn something new. We cannot become something that we want to become. Because it's through the interactions and the transactions of conversation that we learn enough about those possibilities and learn enough to know what choices we want to make. So can designers do this? Can we make interactions or enable interactions, create conditions for great conversations, increase the number of choices open to all? That's another whole talk about wanting to increase choices for everyone. Help us to be what we want to be or to become. So this colloquy thing, this nutty from outer space thing that doesn't seem to do very much, and yet has this kind of conversational interaction that's thinly veiled male-female gender joke, known by Pask, by the way, to be a horrible cliche. He was well ahead of the times. And what I think it tells us today is that this kind of organic, analog, immersive, cooperative, competitive, surprising, novel kind of thing is what we lack in the technologies that we are building. I can ask Siri to tell me a joke, and boy, are those jokes stupid. Maybe some enjoy them, maybe they're intended for a different age group than me. But I certainly can't joke back and forth with it the way I can with a friend and learn something new about that friend and go somewhere that's not obvious. So what I've tried to offer tonight is the idea that if we start from models of conversations as design patterns, then I think we can make better progress. Because what are we doing today? We're using digital patterns, parsing sentences, or complex AI machine language, or machine learning models that are mysterious and we have no idea what it's doing and we'll never know, and all of the issues that arise from that technology. I think that striving for interfaces that have some sense of cooperation, ethics, and humanity, it's like mom and apple pie. Why is anyone saying that? Of course, well, of course, of course, of course. I don't hear people talking about building Alexa skills that do this. And I'm trying to build a bridge in hopes of doing that. And teaching a course in the spring at Carnegie Mellon with the idea that if you start from what Alexa skills do today and you try to push the students into a more interesting direction, you won't get very far because you're pulling very hard. But if you start from this higher point of view, this ethical, humane, philosophical perspective, and then you say, okay, what does that mean operationally? What does that mean implementationally? Then maybe you're only here instead of way down there, which is where you've been if you started with the technology. See what I mean? So these are my offers today. I look forward to the conversation. Thank you very much. Okay, let me have it. Go ahead.
Alexa is kind of stupid because it's a pure action machine. You cannot have the dialogue. I totally agree with that. There are approaches where people collaborate to build chatbots of this kind of thing.
To build what?
Chatbots. These chatbot channels.
The Alexa products.
Exactly, yeah. So what do you think, which technical component is missing in Alexa that would enable to have a conversation?
I would say, so what's missing in Alexa and in the
from
Alexa?
From a technical perspective.
From a technical perspective. Two things. One is that one is hard, and one is, even in the last half hour, we've established an enormous number of common touch points. It would have been more if you had been speaking more. But we have some establishment of what we now share, beyond being human, beyond being an modal, beyond being on squirrel hub, right? All that attention. So I don't see in the industry, with prominence, the forefronting of the building of that shared knowledge, which only you and I have, which we build as a, which we use as a scaffold to the thing we want to do next and next and next and next. Humans do this naturally. We do it even when we say hello to the guy on the street and say, you know, how have you been? I'm fine, but anyway. So building the common ground, I don't understand why there aren't conferences about that alone, because that's a missing piece. I don't hear Alexa worried 5 minutes from now that I said something 5 minutes ago that it now has no clue of. So that's one. The other is, I believe that this architecture of distinguishing between goals and means is very powerful. Because if I say to Alexa, play me music, and somehow after 20 minutes it can't play music that satisfies me, if it were a human, the human would say, but Paul, what's wrong? Why do you want to listen to music? And I would say, my dog died, or I'm depressed, or I want to go to sleep, whatever it may be. But asserting that goal and then having a conversation at the level of goal allows me to reevaluate how I want to achieve the goal.
So how would you represent that?
How would I represent that? How much time do you have?
Half an hour.
So pass. I could do a lot in half an hour, but that would be an imposition because these folks have not agreed for that. Pass developed a knowledge representation scheme expressly for the purpose of doing what we're talking about. And it's not like scripts or databases or semantic nets or any of those things, frames. It's different than all of those things, and it has a lot of resonance with the way memory seems to work and other things. So there's an answer there, but it's beyond the conversation today. I'd be happy to tell you more about it.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, please come back after this. Question?
So as we're talking about this concept of interactive interfaces, in order for any kind of interface to give a response back, wouldn't it have to process what you're feeding in? How does the whole concept of user privacy play into this whole system?
So the question is user privacy. One of the big problems today is everything I say to Siri goes to the cloud. And the good news about Apple, which you may or may not know, by the way, is there's a chip which listens for the word, hey, Siri. And if it doesn't hear that, it sends nothing to the cloud. Unlike Alexa, which sends everything. So that's the beginning of a barrier. But if I can run it on my device right here, and it doesn't go to the cloud, what's the privacy issue? So I believe that there are ways of encapsulating bits of data and only sharing the parts that I want to share in order to get as far as I can. I'm not saying that that erases all of your concerns, but there are solutions to that. A colleague of mine has been working for a while in what's called self-sovereign AI, and it's an application of blockchain and a few other things to share only the data on a moment-to-moment basis that, for example, a hospital or a doctor or a company might want or a dating service might want, rather than have all of the data out there for anyone to do whatever they want with. So I think there are ways forward in that. I'm not a privacy expert, but my multiple answers are just as stated. Thank you for that question.
Would you share an example of a machine that took a little closer to
I can't give you an example in the realm of speech interfaces, but PASS built some machines, and I imitated some of them, which were essentially learning machines. Actually, let me give you an example. I wonder if I have it here. I may. The question is, will you recognize it as what I'm intending? No. I can describe it from here. So imagine that this is a pop-up window, this square thing that says King of Clickbait, but let me explain the context. I don't have the demo right here. So you're reading a web page, and you're reading happily paragraph, paragraph, link, and you think, oh no, should I click on that link? And then you realize, if I click on it, I wait, it comes, I get the page, I have to avoid the advertisements. It's a pain. What if you could ask the author of that page, who knows something about you, because you've been talking to them on and off lately, what if you could say to the author, hey, give me a paragraph from that page that you think suits me? And the pure Pascian algorithm for that is, and this is what our software did, it was running in real time on Amazon for a long time. It goes to the page, it segments the page, and then it characterizes each segment of the page in terms of what you've seen and not seen. So it looks at the first paragraph and said, Paul's seen that already, never mind, that would be redundant. Second paragraph, whoa, that has nothing to do with what he's been thinking about and reading about. So that's two out to lunch. Here's a paragraph, it's got a couple of new things in it, but it also has a couple of things he was just looking at. So the degree of novelty is exactly what a person who's a good conversant would say to you, knowing what you know already, and who gives you. That's what it did, and that's how it worked. So this is a kind of conversation with content. It uses its knowledge of you, yes, it has to know some things about you, to judge what's too the same and boring, too new and crazy for you and unconnected. What's that new thing that's new enough but connected enough to where you've been to present? I claim that's a kind of conversation. And it's this is what it did. So you roll over the link, it goes to the link, it picks the paragraph for you in blue, it gives you the image from the thing, from the link page, and the HTML title. But it also goes out to the web. It went out to the web in real time. And it looked, it did a Google search, and it knew which keywords to use, and then it went to new pages that you hadn't rolled over, and it picked paragraphs from those new pages and presented those. It was absolutely fantastic. And everybody in the small startup I had loved using it. And we would show it to publishers. And the publishers would say, well, that may be $40,000 a month in advertising. So Condé Nast, New York Times, National Geographic. Thank you, but no thank you. We go to VCs, you know what they say? You're using Google as your back end? Are you crazy? Next question. Please.
Machines don't experience pain or pleasure, so, you know, that's going to impact their motivations and hence their goals. So I don't see how you can really put them on a par with us, given that huge distinction.
So I don't, I'm not the sci-fi guy who's interested in those kinds of empathetic aspects of machines imitating humans. I'm interested in the cognitive side of things. So the description I just gave about this thing being able to look at paragraphs and deciding what's probably new enough for you to be interesting to you doesn't have to feel pain to do that. And I think there's a huge realm which can be fulfilled in that way. So you're talking outside the boundaries of my interests.
You're more concerned with the mind.
Yes. Fair enough.
So I'm curious, the diagram that you showed with the two participants of the conversation and the dividing line between them, and when we've got two human participants or one human and one machine participant, but what I'm interested in is when the machine is the dividing line between two human participants and how that can affect or change or enhance or degrade the conversation.
It's a lovely question. So Matthew's asking, what if the machine is in the boundary between the A and the B? Well, we need a number of different architectural diagrams, each of which would answer it. One is it's a pass-through. That's not interesting. That's not why you're asking the question. Another would be it's a participant in the conversation and isn't changing what B says to A, but becoming a C in the conversation. And the third one is it's mucking with what B says for some reason. Now, that's perhaps the most interesting one. If it's helping me understand B, because I'm A and it's doing a translation, or whatever, that's good as long as I can trust it. And as long as its goals are compatible with my goals. But it's a lovely architectural question that would be fun to explore further. But given those different modes, I hear a research proposal coming on. I like it a lot. Yes, and you should tell me, Simon, when you run out of time.
The gentleman who asked about pain and stuff, do you think you have an incentive when you're talking to another human being to be a better conversation partner yourself?
Yes.
Have you done work where, so, you know, if I have to be honest, you know, if I want honesty from you, I have to present some novelty to you and understand your context. Have you done work in that, do we ever get to be great conversation we're not baking into the math, encouraging someone to be a good conversation themselves.
I haven't done research on that, but I have a point of view, and I'm working with a colleague now at CMU that whose work would enter into that thing. If I have a machine that is generating some possible answers, and there are a lot of machine learning systems now, Alexa works this way. Alexa can generate 5 different possible answers to tell you, and it will select among those 5. Well, how does it make that selection? It has to have criteria for saying this is the best one for you at this time. Are those criteria about making Alexa a good conversationalist? Does it give the human a new idea that she didn't have before? Does it answer the human's question in a way that extends the possibilities that the human is thinking of and so on? So this implies developing a set of criteria. So the half jump from there is I have an idea that I'm looking for funding for, which is a pivot from the Turing test. So I think you all know the Turing test. It's, can a human decide if a machine is intelligent? I want to flip it. I want a machine to decide if a conversation is intelligent. So this has to have criteria for good parts of conversation. Is it interesting? Is it generative? Does it answer the questions? Does it go somewhere unexpected? Is it enjoyable? Is it surprising? And we have an independent study student now looking at the literature of psychology and linguistics and trying to decide what is that model of all possible conversations and where is the slice of it that you could probably write code to discover. Now think if you have this thing. By the way, instead of a Turing test, we'll call it a Turning test, because in conversations you have turns. Get it? A little joke there? You with me? Now, if you had the Turing test, when you got up in the morning and you looked at your Twitter feed, just think of all the crap you wouldn't have to look at. Because it would tell you the interesting parts, or the valuable parts to you, or the things that had new ideas. It would avoid the repetitions. Right? Think of when you wake up in the morning and you're working on a multinational, multi-time zone company, and you have to look at your Slack channel, and you have to see what people have been saying all night on these myriad Slack channels, and it will say, oh, don't worry about most of it. But here's the one poll for you. This is interesting, and it's valuable for you and your job. Now, the most practical case is, and people are developing this without a Turing test, if you have a doctor and a patient talking, and they're willing to be recorded and to be transcribed, and there are no privacy issues, then the bot could say to the doctor, hey, you know, you asked that guy a question and he didn't answer it. Or here's the part of the exchange where he was explaining his symptoms. Yeah, you want to put that in the medical record. And on and on and on. So there's work already on the idea of how do you get the valuable parts out of a doctor-patient conversation. I'm not trying to generalize that, but that's one example of the case that I'm interested in, which is a machine that will tell me what conversations are valuable, what parts of what conversations are valuable. So that doesn't go very far, but that's an attempt to develop criteria of the sort that your question suggests.
I'm struggling to understand how this tool you were working on is more conversational than, say, Alexa in your example. Is it just more of an advanced search, like you're looking for a preview of content on another page, cross-referencing other content that shows up in your browsing history, the current article, or anything else you're feeding into it as an input?
So how is this demo that I've...
Yeah, like where's the follow-up interaction? If you don't like what you see, where does it go from there?
So there are two questions there. One is the architecture sufficiently different to claim that it's better than a standard search? And it's true that searches do depend on some kind of history of my interactions, what I've selected, what I've not selected, what I've done keyword. But it doesn't work based on this notion, the task called uncertainty regulation or novelty regulation. Because the answer I get from Google as the top result, Luigi's Pizza or whatever, is not computing what it thinks I know already and giving me something sufficiently novel to be valuable to me. That's what good conversation is, or it's one criterion for good conversation. So I'm claiming that even in this primitive form, there's something going on that Alexa does not do, because Alexa does not do that and Google does not do that. It doesn't take into account where am I and what in this range of possible things it could say is the thing that will be valuable to me because it's novel in some way. So that's the first part. I forgot the second part. The back and forth from there. So we did not build the interface of the flip side, although it's not hard to do if you have this architectural model, which would be, no, don't give me that. Tell me something more about this other thing. So in the same way that somebody offers you gluten-free pizza, and you say, no, I don't care about that. What about the mozzarella? Is it fresh? That kind of interchange is possible even in this interface, but we didn't build that half. But I claim that it can't be done. At this same, I don't want to call it primitive level, crude level is a better word, of trying to use content as an example of conversation. Content exchange. I hope that helps. In the back, all the way in the back.
Part of the conversation that's been happening, I think something really interesting is that you still kind of mention the machines as like a subservient tool to a piece, so there's still like a master slave relationship.
Did I say that?
Well, that's kind of like, you're asking these questions like, can you get me better recommendations? Can you ask me a question that pushes my thought, but it's still like you're asking the machine to serve you in a way?
I wasn't thinking of it that way. The question is, am I asking the machine to serve me? I wasn't thinking about that.
So is there a way for the disagreement to happen? We talk about like weakness to A partially like disagreement, like can the machine push back on the agreement?
It should be that way, and we can agree to disagree. You can suggest something to me that I don't like, but I respect your opinion. But these are the kinds of things I would like to explore. I'm not saying I have an answer for every idea you might have, but we don't now operate with an architecture that suggests the kinds of questions we're asking, and that's why I think we're stuck in this transactional model. That may not be very satisfying. That's question. What I would first want to do, the question is, what is manipulation in this context and how do you combat it, avoid it, whatever? My interpretation of manipulation is when the goals that I have in the interaction I have with you are inconsistent with what I say. So I say, wouldn't you like to buy this nice watch? It's a real Rolex. But I know it's not a real Rolex. So that's a lack of reliable transparency, which is a requirement in this ideal world that I present so happily. I realize that there's a lot of idealizations in what I'm talking about. So manipulation, I believe, is modeled by lack of truthfulness in what's going back and forth. I change the truth in order to cause you to be different. That's one example.
Well, there's a difference between deception and a lack of transparency.
So, interesting. So, what's the difference between deception and lack of transparency? So, me telling you a lie versus not telling you what you need to know.
Or reframing something or phrasing it in a way that would,
Putting a spin on it. It's a great example.
You said that your goal would not be in line necessarily with what you're conversing.
Yes. That's right.
What if in, let's just say, romantic situations, the goal is very much in line with what one might be trying to affect the conversation towards the other person.
Well, but I might lie about something or...
You might say something that's not a lie and it's aligned with your goal, but it's could be
it's still deceptive. So we're having fun.
It could be perceived as being...
Right? There are many, many possible solutions. I don't have a taxonomy of these things and how to solve them. And I certainly don't know how to go about creating a culture of design in which there would be concern about these things. I would like to have a culture of design in which the primary concern is the ethical issues and the honesty issues and so on and so forth.
The other thing is the in the manipulation, in the evil manipulation, there's the underlying malice. And the machine's not going to feel malice. Humans feel malice.
Yeah, you're saying the machines can carry out the malice of the programmer or of the company.
Yeah, as an extent, as a tool of another human.
Agreed. Question? Wonderful questions. The second one is, as a species, we're not used to talking to non-species, and so is that inherently an issue? Is it a non-ethical issue in a way? I think that train has left the station. I think children will assume that they can talk to machines and that they're sentient in some way and independent in some way. I think the ethics still resides in the making of those machines and the nature of the algorithms, one kind versus another, a deceptive kind versus another, a manipulative kind versus another. Sorry, what was your first question?
The goal of the species is not to have a conversation with you, but just
So chatbots, for example, Alexa was really invented to sell you dishwashing liquid so that you could order things from Amazon. But I also think this is a matter of having a community of people in which having a machine to help you have a generative conversation, which is valuable for the conversation alone, not for the transactional consequence, or because you're paying a service, or because they're collecting data on how often you ask for the weather. So I guess I'm implicitly advocating for an interest in the industry to build machines that help people have valuable, effective, great conversations.
Do you think it's like improving the interaction experience?
I think the purpose of designing a conversational machine of the sort I want is to have better conversations in a world that needs more of them, especially now where Facebook and other social media are absorbing our brain power and taking away the thing that is not just social, but generative and interesting and interactive and unexpected between humans. And we need an antidote to that, and maybe one antidote is to have the machines get better at it. Can I find someone who has not asked a question yet? Yes, please.
So as conversations with Alexa are getting better, let's assume that one day it gets to that point that it is great at conversations. Is there a danger that that devalues our interactions and conversations with other humans, and could it like possibly even replace it?
So if Alexa gets better and better, does that devalue conversations that humans have with humans? Because a human can have a conversation with a machine. I can imagine a world in which, as I said a minute ago, children grow up expecting a certain kind of thing, and where human beings, as children growing into adults, are not concerned about the difference between talking to another machine or talking to another human. I was born in 1951, and that was kind of a pivot in technology. Mainframes were beginning. When I got to college, I could play with a computer. That was unusual in those days. Hands-on. But I grew up in a world in which it was the human conversation that was the important part. So I, as a human being, in my experience, don't want a world in which the distinction between human-to-human and human-to-machine conversations is lost. I just don't want that, because I think they're different. And I think they will always be different. And even if you could make a machine that knew pain, still ain't the same. Might make it better at being a therapist or being a good friend when you're in tragedy. But my interest is not that. However, I would like to have Alexa better because it kind of sucks right now. And I think the world would be a better place if Alexa were better, and if you could have better conversations. Maybe in the same way that a child uses a calculator to do great math, that they might interact with a machine that might give them a better sense of what good conversational skills are, which they then bring to humans. But that's a slippery slope, and I'm not sure I want to go there.
Alexa does reach that point where it does talk like a human, would the physical form have to evolve to that point too? Or do you think, like, this thing speaks like a human and that's sufficient? Like, I mean, like,
does there have to be a physical form that reflects a human being? God forbid. Don't quote me, but I don't like robots. I mean, I love science fiction movies that have robots in them, but I don't like the idea of being surrounded by robots. I don't think it will matter because it'll be in the wall. You're not worried about the electrical wiring going up in that wall, and I think if the wall could talk to you, you wouldn't worry about its form. So I don't need a physical form myself to interact with it, and I don't think that we will worry about that. Some people will want robots, certain caregiving situations, maybe that's nice to have a warm, furry thing, I don't know. But the form factor to me is not the issue. I think it's more the quality of the interaction. And we've all seen the movie Her. One or two more, is that okay?
Yeah.
One more? Yes.
So when you actually create a conversation between a machine and a human to make it, it's definitely more efficient because it gets to be a goal faster, but what's your take on the learning opportunities that get pushed down or that don't happen?
So I'm not, the question is, if you're focused, well, let me try to paraphrase it, if you're focused on efficiency, what about the loss of learning opportunities? I'm not focused on efficiency. I think it's an engineering goal, and it's when you think there's one parameter that you can make more efficient. But in any human interaction, there are many, many parameters, and there's no such thing as optimization, as much as that word is really used. It's just not that good. So my preference would be to have a concern, in the strong sense of that word, for the learning opportunities, rather than a push just for the efficiency. And maybe that's part of the reason why Alexa is the way it is. It's interested in efficiency. I don't think so. I think there are other things. Thank you. Anyone who hasn't asked a question, and then should that be the last? Okay, we're just letting me have one more.
So, you know, one of the most frustrating things about any of these systems, like Alexa, is they're so, such an imbecile. Right? And they don't remember what you said.
This was my point to the gentleman earlier. What would I want technically would be something to remember.
Why do you think that is? Like if you ask Alexa or Siri for, Siri, tell me a good restaurant. And if you say, hey Siri, that I didn't like the restaurant you recommended. Could you give me something more, and, you know, along the line? I want Italian, but I really want Southern. Why is it that these tools can't sort of take the answer they already gave you and refine it?
The tools can't remember things about you today and take them in a kind of conversational, deliberative way, almost kind of back and forth, what's the possibility. The reason why they don't do that is because the engineers aren't interested in that. And that's my fundamental complaint. And that's why I run around talking about this stuff top down rather than showing the demos of the stuff I built. Because I think the high level points are, humans have been talking for tens of thousands of years. What can we learn from that? And why don't we start there? And then maybe we could bring it down a little bit up to the point where we can build something. The engineers are worried about making money for the business, whatever you can do trivially with natural language processing, et cetera. It's because they have, forgive the terminology, they have the wrong concern. They're concerned about efficiency. They're not concerned about human interaction. They're trying to get something from you rather than wanting to give you something and perhaps to get something in return, which is the reciprocity of conversation. It's the joy of conversation. It's the collaborative mode where you get something and I get something. And by the way, it's not a zero-sum game. Like, you can have this one, and I can have this thing, but we can't both have this thing. We can both have ideas. We can both share our ideas freely and not realize that we will...
do it, right?
Pardon?
They occasionally do it. If you ask Google to make a telephone call, you say, call Bob,
Yes.
It'll say, well, you want Bob's cell phone or you want Bob's phone?
Well, that's a distinction that it knows, and it's helpful to give you those options. But there are options from fixed sets that it already knows. But in conversation, what usually happens is the non-obvious emerges. New possibilities emerge, and I can become someone that I didn't imagine before that I might want to become. And that's my goal for thinking about conversations. Thank you very much for your conversation now. Turned it off.
Oh, okay.
All right, is this still on?
Good.
Thanks so much to Paul for this wonderful talk and conversation afterwards. Thanks for everyone for coming. I want to say thanks again to our food sponsor, Tech Systems, in the back, and for M-Modal for hosting us. And just, if you're interested in this type of event, we have another one coming up in December, on December 5th. You can put it in your calendar right now. The sign-up will be coming soon, but it's going to be on the potential of VR and how you can help. It's a presentation by Sean Patton, principal game designer at Shell Games. So that should be another interesting one in December, and hope to see you there. Thanks.
That was great.
Is that okay?
Such good conversation.
Yeah, that's the sign that it meant something.
It's really great.
Hey there.
I really enjoyed
Thank
it.
You.
I want to ask you, did you ever cross paths with Fernando Flores?
Of course.
Okay, so I worked with him for a couple of years.
Oh, fantastic.
This is back in the 80s.
Yes,
yeah,
of course.
When he was developing the coordinator. And
yeah.
I used the coordinator for a couple of years, but I read,
that's
his
fantastic.
And Winograd's book. And Mascherana, the Chilean biologist, he came a couple of times.
I only crossed paths with Flores maybe once or twice.
Yeah.
But I knew Mascherana pretty well.
Oh, okay.
We did a conference thing a little bit ago where he was on video. And I knew Winograd well. When I was in the Valley, he asked me to teach for him.
Right.
And I taught these models and other models of interaction for about 6 years with a colleague. Yeah. What are you doing now?
I work here at M-Modal.
Uh-huh.
I've done a lot of work in just working with another student, PhD student. I've done a lot of work in linguistics. And I'm just wondering, my specialty is statistics, really. But Irving Goffman.
Yes.
He had this whole structure of experience and blah 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 frames.
I don't know it well, but
it was on and on and on. Like it's not an easy read, but
it touches on
great
these
stuff.
Things, but that's not really my.
But when you look at the sort of the structure of the interactions, the social interactions, it just seems like he has a lot to say. He and others, but he seems to be one of the pioneers.
I agree.
The geniuses behind it.
Yeah, Pass talked about him.
Okay.
Wonderful.
So this is great. My name's John. John Paredes, yeah.
John Paredes, great. Great to meet you. Yeah. If you get in touch with Tommy, if you want to talk about Forrest, we could talk about CyberSyn.
Okay. I'd love to, actually.
Yeah, get in touch with him.
Okay.
Here.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. I'm Abby Locke.
Hi.
Thank you for the talk. It was very applicable to some things I'm working on. I'm now you give me new language for it. I now realize it's conversation. I'm actually a sales consultant. And I'm trying, and my education is design, and I've been in software for the last 10 years, which is why I just started sales consulting, in part because I've worked with so many sales people that are acting more like Alexa in conversation. They have a goal, and they're all to get it, and I'm trying to, I've also worked with other types that are more about the possibility. And when they walk into the sales conversation, they end up nowhere where they imagined they would end up. And with the deal side.
Bravo.
And so I'm trying to bring that. And so this is really helpful in terms of bringing new language. So thank you.
Great.
Yeah.
Thanks for saying that.
Yeah.
Great. If I can help in any way,
I appreciate it.
Talk about it.
Thank you.
Good. Thanks. Hello. How are you?
Is there a space within this model for the machine?